Welcome to our program once again, Salvation History, the Old Testament, the story of the creation, fall, and the beginning of the redemption of all humankind. I'm your host, Monsignor Larry Moran, chaplain down at Carmelite Monastery at the entrance of Allendale, south of Terre Haute, and chaplain of John Paul II Catholic High. Our guest, as usual, and our theologian in residence is Ron Eldred, who teaches religion and teaches history at John Paul II Catholic High School for the past 11 years. Ron, welcome back again to our program. And we've been discussing the two kingdoms of Israel after the death of King Solomon. So could you bring us up to date, maybe a brief rundown on what we have thus far discussed about this matter, which gets rather complicated at times?
Yes, it seems like a little tedious, so we'll try to cut through it here, because I think that's a good idea. When Solomon died in 922 BC, although I have seen the date 930 in some other sources, his kingdom was divided into two parts. The northern kingdom of Israel, with Samaria as its capital, and the southern kingdom of Judah, with Jerusalem as its capital. 10 of the tribes of Israel resided in Israel, that is the northern kingdom. And the tribe of Judah and part of the tribe of Benjamin resided in Judah, the kingdom of Judah. This division of Solomon's kingdom was punishment for his many sins during the latter half of his reign. We had discussed how, at least during the early part of his reign, he pretty well fulfilled what we think of Solomon as being wise. But as he got older, he became more and more foolish. And so we won't, you know, go over what we describe then, but he did a lot of things, of course, to offend God. And so the division of the kingdom was punishment after he died. The northern kingdom was the last from 922 until 721, or 722, I've seen both dates, when it fell to the Assyrians because of its wickedness. None of the 20 kings that ruled Israel during that time period were good men, perhaps Ahab being the worst. You remember, he was the husband of the wicked Jezebel. And all of them and their people practiced idolatry and routinely violated the rest of the commandments. God sent prophets to warn them that they had broken their covenant with him, such as Elijah and Elisha and others, but to no avail. The southern kingdom lasted until 587 BC, although I've also seen the date 586, because of God's promise to David, and because it had several good kings of its 20 or so during this period, including Jehoshaphat, who we've already talked about, Uzziah, who we talked about, and as we shall see, Hezekiah and Josiah. It also had a lot of bad kings, such as Jehoram and Ahaz, and as we will discuss later, Manasseh. These and other Judahite kings led their people to idolatry and immorality, just as some of the kings had done, all the kings had done in the northern kingdom. And, as with the northern kingdom, God sent several prophets to warn them that they had broken their covenant with God, such as Isaiah and Jeremiah and quite a few others. But again, as with the northern kingdom, in the long run, this was to no avail. And eventually, God allowed the Babylonians to conquer them in 587 BC and to carry off the leadership into captivity into Babylon. And this fulfills the Deuteronomic theme that if the Israelites kept their covenant with God, they would be rewarded with peace, prosperity, and fruitfulness. On the other hand, if they broke it, they'd be punished with war, famine, disease, pestilence, and natural disasters.
Well, you mentioned King Ahaz. I think we talked about him. How about King Hezekiah?
Yes, Ahaz was the last one we discussed in our last session. And he was one of the most wicked kings of Judah. And if he had been one of the worst kings, his son Hezekiah turned out to be one of the best. He is believed to have reigned from 727 to 698 B.C., and he is known for being a great reformer, initiating reforms that enforced Jewish laws against the worship of Baal and Asherah and other traditional Near Eastern divinities. The Bible portrays him as, quote, a great and good king, following examples of his great-grandfather, Uzziah. The book of 2 Kings 18 praises him for saying, quote, he trusted in the Lord, the God of Israel, so that there was none like him among all the kings of Judah after him, nor among those who were before him. For he held fast to the Lord. He did not depart from following him, but kept the commandments which the Lord commanded Moses. The Lord was with him. Wherever he went forth, he prospered. He rebelled against the king of Assyria, who would not serve him. He smote the Philistines as far as Gaza and its territory, from watchtower to fortified clay. This is found in 2 Kings 8, 5 through 8. Hezekiah, he abolished the shrines on the high places and in the groves where pagans would have their shrines, and smashed the pillars and cut down the sacred post, which was a sacred tree or pole that stood near Canaanite religious locations to honor the mother goddess Asherah and the consort of El, the greatest of the Canaanite gods. He concentrated worship in Jerusalem, where God had always intended, in the temple there. He also had the bronze serpent destroyed, which Moses had made, because the Israelites had been offering sacrifices to it. In other words, they were treating this bronze serpent as an idol. I read that the scholars have debated whether that actually was the same serpent that Moses had had in the 40 years in the desert, but I'll take the Bible's word for it. What's more, he also resumed the Passover pilgrimage for the tribes of Israel. This story is all told in 2 Chronicles chapter 30. And during his reign, the kingdom of Israel was conquered by the Assyrians in 722 B.C. In other words, the northern kingdom was conquered while he was king of the southern kingdom. Judah was invaded and Jerusalem besieged by the Assyrians in 701 B.C. during his reign, but the siege ended when a miraculous plague afflicted the Assyrian army, killing many, many of them. But the Assyrians had conquered so much of Judah that the people came to yearn for an ideal king who would restore the golden age of David. This is when the idea of the Messiah, you know, becomes more and more prevalent. And Isaiah and Micah both prophesied during his reign, and he was succeeded by his son Manasseh, as we'll find out, was not a good king. And essentially, though, what happened, even during his reign, Judah had become a vassal to the big, huge empire north of there called Assyria.
Okay, now the one thing, Ron, before we go to King Manasseh, seems to be like the returning of a chorus in a song, that the people turn away from God and they're punished with war, disease, famine, destruction. And when once in a while a good king comes along, like good King Hezekiah, then they begin to prosper once again. It seems to be that they're always going to eventually get back into that idolatry, which seemed to always involve some kind of immorality in some kind of a god worship, in sacred prostitution or something. And that's why it seems like a quicksand that they were always brought back into.
Humans can't seem to stand prosperity. I don't care what society it is and however you want to explain it psychologically, sociologically, or religiously. they just simply can't. They become more materialistic, and in other words, they desire more and more material things: power, property, prestige, privilege, possessions, and things like that. They become more hedonistic. In other words, they want to have more and more fun, and as they become more and more prosperous, yes, pleasure. Seems to be the part of the human condition which has fallen, of course.
Boy, it certainly is echoed over and over again in this the kings that we've been talking about. Well, let's go on from good King Hezekiah to King Manasseh, who wasn't he reportedly one of the most wicked of the kings of Judah or of the southern kingdom?
Yes, he was. He certainly didn't follow his devout father's footsteps. He did a lot of damage to Judah during his reign, which lasted from 693 to 639 B.C. A lot of that's told in certain 2 Kings 20th chapter and through there. He reintroduced all kinds of idolatry and superstition, and he had the altars built to the host of heavens, even in the temple, in other words, pagan altars. 2 Kings 21 says of his reign, quote, Manasseh was 12 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 55 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Hephzibah, and he did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, according to the abominable practices of the nations whom the Lord drove out before the people of Israel. For he rebuilt the high places, which Hezekiah his father had destroyed. And he erected altars for Baal. And he made Asherah as King Ahab of Israel had done, and worshipped all the host of heaven and served them. And he built altars in the house of the Lord, that is, in the temple itself, of which the Lord had said, In Jerusalem will I put my name. He built altars for all the host of heaven and the two courts of the house of the Lord. Those are the outer courts, of course, of the temple. And he burned his son as an offering and practiced soothsaying and augury and dealt with mediums and with wizards. He did such evil in the sight of the Lord, provoking him to anger. And the graven image of Asherah that he had made, he set in the house of which the Lord said to David and to Solomon his son. This story is told in 2 Kings 21. According to one source, later rabbinical accounts claim that, quote, Manasseh placed a grotesque four-faced idol in the Holy of Holies, end of quote. Well, the Holy of Holies, of course, is the place where they kept the Ark of the Covenant, and it was a place that was believed where God...
most sacred place in the temple.
Yes, it was believed by the Jews that that's where the God ruled his people from. There is a tradition that he had the prophet Isaiah sawed in half. He also shed a lot of innocent blood throughout the kingdom. Scott Hahn has said, has this to say about him. Quote, When Hezekiah died, his son Manasseh succeeded him. It would be hard to imagine a greater contrast between father and son. Hezekiah had pulled down the high places. Manasseh built them up again. Hezekiah had thrown out all the foreign idols. Manasseh brought them back. Manasseh defiled the very temple of God with pagan altars and images. He even burned his own sons as an offering to the horrible pagan gods. He massacred innocent citizens in his own capital of Jerusalem, persecuting the worshipers of God and turning the true religion into an underground cult. An ancient tradition says that one of his victims was Isaiah the prophet, whom he had cut in two with a saw. No king of Judah had ever been so purely wicked. Judgment came on them swiftly.
Really startling. So again, a reminder that child sacrifice was practiced among the pagans, as among our own Aztecs in South America. And as is going on in what we'd call the child sacrifice of abortion today. Well, because of his and his people's really great wickedness, God foretold through his prophets that Judah and Jerusalem would be severely punished. Can you comment for us on that?
Well, for one thing, Judah was forced to become a vassal of Assyria, as we suggested a while ago. The book of 2 Kings 21 says of this matter, quote, "And the Lord said by his servants the prophets, because Manasseh, king of Judah, has committed these abominations, and has done things more wicked than all of the Amorites did who were before him, and has made Judah also to sin with his idols. Therefore, thus saith the Lord, the God of Israel, behold, I am bringing upon Jerusalem and Judah such evil that the ears of everyone who hears of it will tingle. And I will stretch over Jerusalem the measuring line of Samaria and the plummet of the house of Ahab. And I will wipe Jerusalem as one wipes a dish, wiping it and turning it upside down. And I will cast off the remnant of my heritage and give them into the hand of their enemies. And they shall become a prey and spoil to all their enemies, because they have done what is evil in my sight, and it provoked me to anger since the day of their fathers came out of Egypt, even to this day." This is in 2 Kings 21.
So it's a dire, threatening prophecy. Did Manasseh repent of his sins toward the end of his reign?
Not until his kingdom was invaded by the Assyrians and he was carried off to Babylon and held a captive. There he asked God for forgiveness and was restored to his throne. He proved that he was genuinely repentant because he had the foreign gods and the idol from the house of the Lord and all the altars that he had built on the mountain of the house of the Lord and in Jerusalem. He threw them outside the city. He also restored the altar of the Lord and offered upon it sacrifices of peace offerings and of thanksgiving. And he commanded Judah to serve the Lord, the God of Israel. Nevertheless, the people still sacrificed at the high places, but only to the Lord, their God. In other words, they were still sacrificing and not just exclusively in the temple, which they had been forbidden to do, of course, in these high places, but at least they weren't sacrificing to these pagan gods, but to the true God. And he was succeeded by his son Amon in 642 B.C., or Amon, however you choose to pronounce it.
Okay, so at least towards the end, after being greatly punished himself in the Babylonian captivity, then he begins to change. How about his son, King Amon, who you mentioned? Did he carry on his father's repentance, or did he take the slippery slope again?
Well, sorry to say, he wasn't a good one. In fact, he was as wicked a king as had been his father Manasseh before his conversion. He began his reign in 642 B.C. when he was only 22 and reigned for only 2 years, which, of course, was a sign of God's disfavor of him. He continued his father's practice of idolatry during his reign, and his reign was marked by a lot of moral depravity. Eventually, he was assassinated by one of his own servants and was succeeded by his son, Josiah, who was only 8 years old at the time. This story is told in 2 Kings 21 and 22. One biblical scholar has said of Amon's reign, quote, "The only positive contribution Amon made to the history of Judah was to produce one of the best kings to reign on the throne of Jerusalem," end of quote.
Boy.
And that's Josiah, of course.
Now, isn't that amazing? Seems like King Hezekiah, good king, and then his son Manasseh becomes one of the worst kings. And then Amon continues to be a bad king, and he produces one of the best kings. That's a little hard to understand. I guess we'll have to say it's the grace of God at work. Well, what about King Josiah? Why was he one of the best kings of Judah?
Well, he's known as the great reformer because he temporarily brought Judah back to the proper worship of God. As the story goes, one day when the temple was being repaired, one of the priests found an old scroll in the archives. One scholar speculates that apparently it had been hidden away to keep it safe from Manasseh's soldiers during the worst part of his persecution. During that period, the true priests had been massacred in the streets, at least many of them had been. So the priests had found it, they brought it to Josiah, and he had it read to him. While he heard what it was in the book, he was so distressed that he tore his clothes. Of course, that was a way, of course, of showing, you know, horror and extreme disapproval. Scholars believe that they had found the book of Deuteronomy, the second law of Moses containing the Deuteronomic theme, that the Israelites would flourish when they obeyed God's commandments and languish when they broke them. Josiah had the book read to the people who agreed to abide by the law. They made a covenant with God, agreeing to keep all the commandments. Afterwards, Josiah had all the pagan altars destroyed, especially those used to sacrifice children to Moloch, and expelled all the cult prostitutes. He also had the pagan shrines in the high places destroyed as well.
Wow. Wasn't it too late for the people of Judah to repent of their sins?
Yes, it was. The priest had consulted with the prophetess named Huldah, who told them to tell the king that it was too late for a reformation of the people of Judah, that God's wrath toward them was too great. But she said that the final downfall wouldn't occur during Josiah's reign because his heart was penitent and he had humbled himself before the Lord. This story is told in 2 Kings 22. As one scholar has said, quote, he decided to do what was right, even if there would be no immediate benefit, end of quote. In other words, he knew that it wasn't going to last, but he still went ahead and did what was the right thing to do.
Heroic.
After this, Pharaoh, the cow of Egypt, marched against Babylon and was opposed by Josiah. And in this battle at Megiddo, near Mount Carmel, Josiah was mortally wounded and died of his wounds in Jerusalem. During his reign, Jeremiah and Zephaniah prophesied, and Jeremiah wrote Lamentations on the occasion of the king's death. This story is told in 2 Chronicles 35.
Okay, Ron, we've talked about many and most of the bad kings of the North and the South Kingdom. We talked about good King Hezekiah and good King Josiah, who even made reforms knowing that it wasn't going to change anything. What about the prophet Isaiah? He's coming up a lot in our story. Can we say something about Isaiah, who was so important in his prophecies?
Yes, he certainly was one of the greatest of the prophets. Sometimes he's also called Isaiah. He was the first of the four major prophets. And by major, we just simply mean not that he was necessarily more important than some of the others, but what he wrote was longer. Okay. As we discussed in an earlier session, he was an 8th century B.C. prophet sent to the kingdom of Judah during the reigns of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, and at the beginning of Manasseh, who, as we said, tradition has it that had him sawed in half. According to one source, he must have been active as a prophet for at least 55 years. If Elijah was the main prophet sent to warn the northern kingdom of Israel for its unfaithfulness to God, Isaiah was the principal prophet sent to warn the southern kingdom of Judah of its disloyalty to God. The name Isaiah signifies Yahweh, or the Lord is salvation. He must have come from the upper classes, because he apparently served as an officer and counselor to kings of Judah. He was a contemporary and compatriot of the prophet Micah. He lived during a time of crisis for Judah because it was caught in the middle of the political intrigue of her neighbors, the kingdoms of Israel and Syria, as well as the Assyrian Empire, all in the north and Egypt in the south. They were right in the middle of these, these empires, the Egyptian Empire and the Assyrian Empire to the north. So they were getting squeezed all the time.
Ron, the story of Isaiah's call to be a prophet is quite well known. Can you tell us the details of this marvelous story?
This event happened around the year 735 BC in the southern kingdom of Judah. As the story goes, one day when he was praying in the temple, he saw an apparition of God sitting upon a throne being worshipped by seraphic angels, who are the mightiest and the most glorious of all the angels. The seraphim were singing, "Holy, holy, holy, the Lord God of hosts. All the earth is full of his glory." I think that the three holies are implicit reference to the Holy Trinity. There are several places in the Old Testament where there's implicit reference to the Trinity, but nothing explicit. The vision made Isaiah aware of his own sinfulness compared with God's holiness, and he was so overwhelmed by his majestic vision that he thought he would surely die because of the enormity of his sins. Before he could die, however, one of the seraphim brought him a burning coal, which he had taken from the tongs, with his tongs, from the altar, and touched his lips with it. And as the angel touched his lips with the hot coal, he told Isaiah that his sins were forgiven, that God had a mission for him, but the Lord wouldn't give it to him until he expressed a willingness to do his will. God called Isaiah, saying, quote, "Whom shall I send, and who shall go for us?" Isaiah answered, "Here I am, send me." It's very famous, of course. Ann Carroll writes of this matter in her textbook, Christ the King, Lord of History, quote, "Like Abraham, Isaiah accepted his mission immediately and totally, without doubt or reservation, and with all of his being. But God had a mission for this young man. His mission was a terrifying one, to tell his people of the destruction that would come upon them because they had not fulfilled the Sinai covenant. He must tell them in all the frightening detail so that when the destruction did come, they would know that it was the result of their sins. The people had sought earthly glory, but they had turned to false gods. Therefore, they must be punished so that they would realize there was one God alone." End of quote.
Ron, can you briefly summarize the purpose of Isaiah's mission? We've got about 2 minutes.
Father Kenneth Baker, in his Inside the Bible, states that basically that Isaiah's message was the same throughout his ministry, that the king and the people should trust in God, abide by the covenant, and avoid all idol worship, not get involved in foreign treaties and wars. He says that although he did have some access to the king and his advisors, they usually ignored his advice and tried to solve their political problems by making treaties with Assyria and Egypt and some of the small neighboring cities. This turned out to be a disaster for Jerusalem and Judah.
Okay, Ron, our time is running out on us, so thanks to our listening audience. May God bless you all, always, and in all ways.